So, we have these four qualities of loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy or joy in the happiness of others, and equanimity. Equanimity being the, I think of it as the voice of wisdom or the articulation of wisdom, especially in the form of balance, or perspective is another way of saying it. Just like I said peace, it's some perspective on things. So sometimes that wisdom is a quality of remembering that everything's changing all of the time. Sometimes it's remembering that, sad to say, I'm not in control of the unfolding of the universe, that I can't make things just so. Sometimes it's remembering that we can just hold things with a bigger view. Sometimes in a different context, in Tibetan Buddhism, they have this saying, they say, look at the thoughts, or let's say the thoughts and feelings that come up in your mind as though you were quite an elderly person sitting in a playground watching children play. So look at the thoughts that come up in your mind as though you were quite an elderly person sitting in a playground watching children play. And I've always liked that because it brought a lot of things together for me in that image, like tenderness, care, poignancy, and also some perspective. You know, you've lived a life, you've been through a lot, but you see like a little kid break their shovel and have a meltdown, you don't say, hey kid, it's just a shovel, you know? Like wait till you have a mortgage, you know, or something like that. It's not cold, it's not disdainful. There's so much like, oh, you broke your shovel, but you also do know it's just a shovel. There's some perspective that comes from life experience of going up and going down and having lots of shovels break. So it's not coldness or indifference, but you also don't freak out. You don't get down on the ground with the kid and say, oh my God, you broke your shovel. And I think of that also in terms of service or helping. You know, if I were looking for help from someone, that's kind of the combination I would want. I would want that tenderness and care and presence and also some bigger perspective. You know, if I told someone my very troubling story and they like completely freaked out, I would think, oh wow, I'm really in trouble. You know, I even frightened them. But I don't want someone removed and uncaring either, of course. So that kind of perspective of that very elderly person looking at a child play is some of that sense of spaciousness. It doesn't obviate or negate the caring and the tenderness or the action to try to make things better. It's just held in a different way. So that, even though that's used in that other context, I think it's an image that helps convey some of this sensibility. Because the space doesn't come from not caring, it comes from perspective. It comes from a kind of wisdom. And you see that it doesn't make the other stuff go away, the kindness, the compassion, and so on. But it can really help, actually, sustain it in many ways. So we have loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. Loving kindness is, friendship is a literal translation of metta. It is a sense of connection. Compassion is the trembling or the quivering of the heart in response to seeing pain or suffering. It's an actual movement of the heart. Sympathetic joy is taking delight in the happiness of others. And then we have the balance of equanimity. So as, you know, we've been doing, you can really take just one of those practices, like loving kindness, and infuse that one practice, that one form, with the qualities, the energy of the other three. We did loving kindness just before for a friend who's doing well, that's like sympathetic joy. For a friend who's having difficulty, that's like compassion. And always there's equanimity in there somewhere, or wouldn't actually be loving kindness. You also can, and we do really deepen the force of equanimity through mindfulness, because anything that brings wisdom will bring equanimity. It's the spaciousness that comes from wisdom. And as someone expressed interest in, they are four very similar but also distinct practices. There's in this tradition, there are phrases that are really about loving kindness, those that are about compassion, those are about sympathetic joy, and those that are about equanimity. And if you chose to, you could really devote yourself more to one particular attribute or another for a period of time, although they are very, very closely related as well. With compassion, we are looking at the truth of suffering, if not direct, immediate, graphic, intense suffering, then just that kind of vulnerability, the fragility that we all live in and with, that is the truth of life. And our hearts move in response to that. Some of the development of compassion is a translation process. We look at our own fear or anger or greed or whatever, and instead of calling those bad or wrong or terrible, we see them as states of suffering. We have a different response to that. And just as we do with ourselves, we can do externally. That nowhere, though, you know, as we were talking about before, does the deepening and development of compassion mean that you don't ever try to do anything. You know, that you're not strong or kind of clear or fierce about a boundary or trying to make a difference. That might well be the case. But what's motivating you can be different, a very different sense. And one way of seeing that is to see that the kind of mind state we're normally in may not reflect the truth of how things actually are. So it's going to be very limited in its effectiveness. You know, if you lose, I win. Is that always true? Maybe not. And the kinds of the sense of self and other and separation and or the denial of connection. You know, what happens over there doesn't matter. It's over there, and it's going to nicely stay over there and never ever have any kind of ripple effects that affect me over here. Unlikely, really. I mean, look at the actual nature of things. One of my favorite things to do if I watch the news on TV is to mark how many times the word mindfulness is used and how many times the word interdependence is used, because it's a lot. Maybe meaning very different things, but isn't that interesting? Even if we don't like it, and it's quite resentful or begrudging, we do live in an interconnected universe, and it's getting harder and harder to pretend that what happens over there is going to nicely stay over there and never ripple out and affect us over here. So we awaken more to the truth of things. When we have that kind of understanding, then very often the response we have is this sense of compassion. It's a kind of movement of the heart, but it doesn't mean we take no action. Very often, one of my favorite book titles of mine was the force of kindness, which was suggested to me by the publisher of that particular book. And I thought, I like that. Because so often when we think of kindness, it doesn't occur to us that it's like a force. It seems like really kind of a secondary virtue. You know, if you can't be brilliant and you can't be wonderful and you can't be courageous, well, like, okay, be kind, you know. It's like, it's nice, but not that nice, you know. It's like, well, it's too nice, it's not that strong. And but really, it's not like that. If we look at compassion, we look at kindness, we look at loving kindness, these are like forces. They're radical and transforming forces in this world because it means we see everything differently and more truthfully. So we try to act from a place that is motivated by that kind of understanding. What action we take in any given circumstance hopefully is informed by a kind of a bigger sense of mindfulness that takes in the context that we're in. It's almost a kind of sometimes I just call it our best guess of what's most skillful. Sometimes it is a question of learning skills, like we were talking about earlier, learning better skills of communication or whatever. Sometimes it's just really trying to learn to listen more to context. And we learn from mistakes, we learn from feedback. And that is, it's the fruit of a growing mindfulness and understanding of paying attention. So in terms of an action that we take from this perspective, we can talk about the motivation, which we're continually changing as we grow, as we understand, as we transform. We talk about, you could say, the skillfulness or unskillfulness of the execution of that motivation. It's the action we take based on context. Now, if I want to give you something, do I try to do it privately? Should I do it publicly? Maybe I should say this, or maybe I should try to say that. If I have some difficult news to convey, maybe I shouldn't do that, you know, so publicly. There's a kind of sensitivity we can develop. And then the third part of the action, in a way, is the part that's outside of our control. That's how it's received. You know, I pick up this flyer for Sukhni Rinpoche in this very place, July 30th to August 1st, program on awakening love. And out of this very beautiful and kind motive, I hand it over to one of you, but maybe you are having a really bad day and you get really kind of upset. You think, oh, it's not enough I did this workshop. I have to do the next workshop too. She must think I'm really bad off, you know? Like, that's, you know, that's awful news. And you take it in a certain way, and you feel insulted, and you kind of, yeah, thanks. And you walk away, maybe even leaving me with this flyer in my hand, trying to give it to you. So what happens at that moment? You know, from the Buddhist point of view, to understand a sense of integrity, we have to look back at our motivation, like, why did I do that? And, you know, take a look, in all honesty, at the skillfulness of how we did it. You know, it was a person sitting there silently in great peace, and I tapped them on the shoulder and I said, hey, you know, we're not. But that place where we can't control the response is also very important to look at, because that's one of the places we really need equanimity. Because we will never be able to control the response. You can't say to someone, you know, 2 o'clock, something's going to happen in the main meditation hall. I want you to come in and don't think about anything. I'm not going to tell you what's going to happen, but something is going to happen. And you might even get handed something. It might look like a flyer, but, you know, I don't want you to have any judgment. I don't want you to be in any kind of mood. I don't want you to have checked your email or your phone messages or talked to anyone at home. Just come in blank. You know, life isn't like that. And so it doesn't mean that we don't reflect back on those other elements. It doesn't mean that we can't continue to learn. And it also doesn't mean, we moved from a response to not being thanked. I mean, of course we care. As a human being, we like it when someone thanks us, when they express gratitude, when they come back to us and say, you know, I went to that workshop, I got completely enlightened. You're telling me to go to that. It was the best thing that ever happened to me in my entire life. Of course we like that, but we can't count on it. And the kind of devastation that comes when that doesn't happen is also very impactful. And we will never be able to count on it. We just don't know. There are too many factors, too many conditions coming together in every moment. So while we care as a human being, it's only reasonable to care, one of the questions is how much do we care? Do we feel we've completely failed because a person didn't get better according to our timetable? Because a friend didn't change their life? Because an seemingly intractable system kind of moved just a little bit and not enough? Or can we actually hang in there with less attachment, less grasping, and a bigger, wider perspective? So that's part of the consequence of equanimity. It's one of the ways it actually bolsters something like compassion. Out of a very compassionate motive, we might do the best we can, and hopefully do the best we can, to try to make a difference in someone's life or in the world. And things don't always work exactly like we want them to work, according to that precise agenda or timetable. It doesn't mean we did wrong. It doesn't mean it was useless. It doesn't mean it was meaningless. It means that hopefully we have the opportunity to sustain what we do without needing an exact result in just a certain way. Because once we do, we're lost. We just don't know how things are going to go. I once had this desire, maybe I'll do it someday. I had a desire to write a book called Basically Clueless. Because I think in many ways we are, and in lucky ways we are too, just in the sense that sometimes we do something toward the good, trying to make a difference, and we can't see the result right away, but somehow, sometime later, we find out that we planted a seed, that it did make the beginning of a difference, or our action ripples out in some other way to affect someone we couldn't have imagined. You know, life is very mysterious that way to us, and we'd like it in neat little packages rather than that mysterious unfolding, but it's not going to be that way. So when we're lucky, sometimes we find out, wow, that was actually a good thing to do. It did plant a seed. And so we have a much bigger, it's almost like a much bigger timetable, you know, time frame. Rather than needing things to be so exactly consequential in the time frame that we might deem. So when we act with compassion and equanimity, what we actually have is a kind of resiliency or buoyancy so that we can carry on. It's not so hard. It can still be very hard in a way, but it's not the same thing as when we just get so despondent because we feel like it's not enough, I can't give enough, I can't change enough, nothing's going to move, nothing's happening, it's a very different sense of spaciousness that does become resiliency. So it's funny, you know, in our culture, in our time, we have words like, or phrases like compassion fatigue. But in, say, a Tibetan Buddhist culture, they find that an extremely amusing term. They say you can have other kinds of fatigue, but not compassion. Compassion's not a tiring element in their minds, and some of the people engaged in the research and around the Dalai Lama have actually, somebody suggested empathy fatigue rather than compassion fatigue. There's a way in which we may feel someone suffering, but something other than compassion gets involved in our reaction, like needing to be the one that makes it all go away, or blaming them for their suffering, or being frightened of their suffering, or just getting so identified with their suffering that it's way too much. We ourselves are kind of traumatized. There are lots of different responses that might happen to a genuine perception of someone's suffering that's not exactly what's meant by compassion. So I don't know what the right phrase is or the right words, but when compassion's talked about as a response to suffering, it has this kind of, again, this sort of hidden element of equanimity and spaciousness in a really big worldview, big sense of life that isn't going to be crushed because something doesn't quite happen by tonight in the ways that we can so easily be. So when we practice compassion meditation, we are also inevitably practicing some equanimity. And the same with sympathetic joy. If you go back to equanimity being the voice of wisdom or understanding, and we look at the quality of sympathetic joy, the joy in the happiness of others, one of the things we see, of course, are the many challenges that keep us from having a very ready sympathetic joy. Now, of course, some people do. Some people seem to have that quality just naturally, and it's very beautiful just to encounter people like that. That, you know, something happens for someone else and they're so happy and it feels like such an incredible kind of generosity. But for most of us, it is a training because we're holding and acting from certain assumptions that will just carry the day unless they're challenged. Assumptions about permanence, like you have everything and you will forever. And I have nothing, and I will forever. Assumptions about happiness. This idea almost that happiness is like a limited commodity in this world, and the more someone else has, the less there's going to be for me. So your happiness has taken something away from me. Or this very funny, weird kind of assumption that I always have trouble putting into words, it's almost the sense that the happiness or good fortune or success was heading right at me and you somehow grabbed it and you took it away. And if you had not done that, it definitely, inevitably would have come to me. Whereas, of course, you know, a lot of times someone else's success or good fortune has nothing to do with us. It's not like I would have gotten it if you didn't. But we have that feeling, that kind of assumption. I have a friend in Madison who is the woman who took me to the prison to teach. And she told me this story when I was staying with her for a while. She told me some story about going to a baseball game, and she was like a complete baseball fanatic. I think from the time she'd been a child, and she went to a baseball game with this friend, or a couple of friends, and somebody did just that. She said she had her glove with her in case she could catch any foul balls. I'm probably going to say this wrong, but not being a baseball fanatic, but you get a sense. So she had her glove with her so she could catch these balls. And she said one was coming right at her. And one of these guys reached his hand to grab it, and it deflected off his palm and went somewhere else. And we actually ran into him quite by coincidence that night. I had never met him before. I said, oh, we were just talking about your dinner, you know. And he was like, in what context? And I said, well, how much they like you, you know. You know, but that's the sense we have is like, oh yeah, it was coming right at me and then you grabbed it or you messed it up for me. So there's a lot of ignorance or confusion or distorted thinking involved in our jealousy, our envy, our unhappiness about someone else's happiness. So in the process of unwinding that and deepening sympathetic joy, we need to grow in wisdom and understanding, and that will give us balance, which is equanimity. So it's right in there. Someone asked about the phrases for equanimity, if one is choosing to do that particular practice in a distinct way. And I'll just repeat, if you do mindfulness practice, you're developing equanimity. If you do loving kindness practice, you're actually developing equanimity. But if you want to, you can also just spend some time doing an equanimity practice using those distinct phrases. The classical phrases within the Buddhist tradition are often very difficult for people because it uses the word karma, which is quite difficult to understand. It can sound like victim blaming and many other things. It's not meant to be that. It's really meant to be that kind of relinquishing of control, that understanding we're not in control. So classical phrases are things like, all beings are the owners of their karma. Their happiness and unhappiness depends upon their actions, not upon my wishes for them. So all beings are the owners of their karma. Their happiness and unhappiness depends upon their actions, not upon my wishes for them. Remember, too, this is not meant to promote indifference, but more that kind of, okay, spaciousness. And there are many other phrases, if that set of phrases doesn't work for you, there are many, many other phrases you could use, like, things are the way that they are. Sometimes people will in a way combine compassion and equanimity, like, I care about your suffering and I know I can't control it. And you're, of course, totally welcome to make up your own phrases that have evoked some of that sense, that sensibility, not of coldness and indifference, but that real open spaciousness.